All right, let's dive into a case that really makes you think, Montana v. Eaglehoff. It's a 1996 Supreme Court case. It really kind of messes with the whole idea of intent.
Yeah.
You know, especially when alcohol is involved.
Yeah, it really makes you think about, like, how much responsibility someone has when they're intoxicated.
Exactly. And it's not just, you know, some bar fight. This is murder.
Right.
Montana, 1992, two people found dead in a car, shot. And guess what? In the back seat, James Eaglehoff, alive, but with a blood alcohol level four times the legal limit.
Wow. So his defense was, I was too drunk to even think about killing. And this is where Montana law gets really weird. At the time, it basically said the jury couldn't even consider Eaglehoff's intoxication when deciding if he did it on purpose or if he knew what he was doing, you know, like the mental state you need for murder.
So basically, it didn't matter how drunk he was. Seems like a pretty big detail to just ignore.
Yeah, it does raise questions about, you know, having a fair trial. Eaglehoff's lawyers said that excluding this evidence was violating his rights. And the Montana Supreme Court actually agreed with that. They said preventing him from talking about this was basically rigging the game against him.
Makes sense. But this obviously doesn't end there, right?
Yeah.
Go straight to the Supreme Court.
Exactly. And the Supreme Court's decision in Eaglehoff, things get complicated. There's no clear majority. We've got Justice Scalia writing the plurality opinion. Then you have Justice Ginsburg concurring, and then you get some pretty strong dissents.
All right, so break it down for us. What'd Scalia say to uphold Montana's law?
Well, Scalia went way back into the history of using intoxication as evidence in American law. Basically said it wasn't traditionally seen as like a core part of justice.
Okay.
He also said that Montana's law didn't actually change who had to prove what. The state still had to prove Eaglehoff meant to kill.
Oh.
But Eaglehoff couldn't use being drunk as an excuse.
So Scalia is saying the state still has to prove intent, but being drunk doesn't automatically get you off the hook.
Exactly. And Scalia brought up some policy reasons too, like saying allowing intoxication as a defense might make people less likely to take responsibility for what they do when they're drunk.
Okay.
And he's worried about confusing the jury.
Interesting. So while upholding the law, he was still thinking about like individual rights and fairness.
Right.
What about Ginsburg? How is her concurring opinion different?
So Ginsburg agreed with the outcome, but she took a different angle. She argued that Montana's law wasn't so much about excluding evidence. It was more about like redefining what purposely and knowingly actually meant.
Hmm.
Basically, she's saying under Montana law, being drunk doesn't even factor into whether someone had the right mental state for murder.
So she's kind of agreeing with the defense's original point. Like, under this law, it didn't even matter if Eaglehoff was drunk when it came to intent.
Yeah, that's a sharp observation. Now, let's look at the dissenting opinions because they really highlight the main conflict in this case. Justice O'Connor really led the charge here, arguing passionately about the presumption of innocence and a defendant's right to present evidence that could help them.
It does seem like a pretty basic idea. You shouldn't be able to just ignore evidence that could help someone prove they're innocent.
Right. So they were saying you can't just sweep this stuff under the rug.
Yeah.
O'Connor pointed out that historically, like, being voluntarily intoxicated was considered relevant in cases, you know, that involved specific intent crimes.
Okay.
She also saw Montana's law as, like, setting a bad example, you know? Like, what's to stop a state from just excluding evidence of mental illness or trauma if they can exclude evidence of being drunk?
Now, that's scary. Makes you wonder if this could be used to, like, limit other mental state defenses in the future.
That was a big worry for those who disagreed. Justice Souter really focused on the need to balance how useful the evidence is versus how much it might unfairly sway the jury. He argued that Montana's law was just a blanket ban, and it didn't do that important balancing.
So he's bringing in the rules of evidence,
yeah,
saying there needs to be a more careful approach, not just a complete ban.
Exactly. But Scalia countered, saying states don't have to follow federal rules of evidence when they make their own criminal laws. And this really gets to the heart of, you know, federalism, like how the states and the federal government have their own areas of power.
So we're seeing this clash between individual rights and state power, and the Supreme Court is siding with the state's right to make its own laws.
Right.
Did the dissenting justices see this as a slippery slope?
Absolutely. They were worried this ruling could encourage other states to restrict intoxication defenses, and that could lead to unfair convictions. Like, if someone's so drunk they're basically on autopilot, can we really say they intended to commit a crime?
That's a tough question. Really gets to what this case is all about. Like, how do we balance accountability with, you know, how complicated human behavior can be,
mm-hmm.
especially with alcohol involved.
Right. And it's not just a theoretical debate. This case has real effects on how trials are run and how we view responsibility in a society where, let's face it, alcohol is everywhere.
This has been incredibly insightful. But before we jump into the lasting impacts of Egelhoff, I think we should take a step back. This case really makes us think about how the law defines and deals with intent. You know, especially when it comes to actions taken under the influence, what does this tell us about how legal concepts change and how societal values can influence those changes?
That's a great point. We tend to think of the law as set in stone, but Egelhoff shows how it's actually constantly evolving, reflecting our changing understanding of how people act and what leads to criminal actions.
So while the Supreme Court sided with Montana, it also kind of opened the door for more debate and potential changes in how we deal with intoxication and intent in the legal system.
Exactly. And that's what makes this case so interesting. It's not just a historical event. It's an ongoing conversation about the core principles of justice and how those principles are used in a world that's always changing.
It's a lot to process, for sure. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's dig into the details of the case. Like, what were some of the key pieces of evidence they presented? And how did those factor into the arguments made by both sides?
Well, to really get the arguments, you got to look at that night in Montana. The crime scene was a mess.
Right.
Egelhoff in the back of the car, the two victims in the front, signs of a struggle, and they found a gun.
Sounds like a movie.
Oh!
So what did the prosecution use to try to prove Egelhoff's intent?
They really focused on what led up to the shooting. Witnesses who had been with Egelhoff that night said he was angry, agitated,
okay.
especially towards one of the victims. So they argued this showed premeditation, that even though he was drunk, he had a reason, a motive, and he acted with purpose.
So they're building this story of intentional violence, even acknowledging the alcohol was there.
Exactly. They're saying, look, even drunk, he could still make choices and carry out planned actions. They even brought in experts to talk about how alcohol affects you, arguing that even with a high blood alcohol level, you can still form intent.
So they weren't ignoring the alcohol. They were addressing it head on to counter the defense's argument that he was just too drunk.
Yeah, they were trying to show that, sure, alcohol might make you less inhibited, but it doesn't completely shut off your ability to make conscious decisions.
All right, what about the defense? How did they use the evidence to argue that Egelhoff was too drunk to have the intent to kill?
They painted a different picture of his state of mind that night, brought in witnesses who talked about how much he'd been drinking, really emphasizing how intoxicated he was.
Okay.
They argued his actions were impulsive, erratic, not like someone with a clear plan.
So they're saying his actions were fueled by alcohol-induced chaos, not some calculated plan.
Right. They were trying to create doubt about whether Egelhoff, in that state, could have actually formed the intent to kill.
This back and forth about intent is really interesting. It seems like the legal fight was all about figuring out what was going on in Egelhoff's mind that night.
Yeah.
Is this where general intent and specific intent come in? Because you mentioned before that historically, intoxication was more important in specific intent cases.
You're absolutely right to bring that up. It's a key difference, and it's at the heart of why Egelhoff is so important. Like we discussed, specific intent crimes require the prosecution to prove that the defendant had a specific mental state, that they acted purposely or knowingly to make something specific happen. General intent crimes, though, only require that the defendant intended to commit the act itself, not necessarily the final outcome.
Okay, so like assault and battery is usually general intent, but something like burglary needs specific intent.
Exactly. With assault, they just have to prove you meant to hurt someone. It doesn't matter if you meant to cause a specific injury. But with burglary, they got to prove you went into the building with the intention of committing a crime inside.
So the difference is really what was going on in the person's head during the crime.
Exactly. And that's where intoxication can get tricky. Even if a drunk person can physically do something, like hit someone or break into a house, it's harder to prove they had that specific mental state you need for a specific intent crime.
So historically, courts were more likely to consider intoxication as a defense for those specific intent crimes, like burglary or, in Egelhoff's case, deliberate homicide.
That's the traditional view. But, you know, like we saw with Egelhoff, even that line's become blurry. Some states have moved away from this general specific intent framework. They use more like nuanced approaches to mens rea, you know, that guilty mind.
Okay.
This makes it harder for defendants to use intoxication as a defense because, like, what you have to prove or disprove about intent can be different from state to state.
Sounds like the whole legal landscape around intoxication and intent is kind of always in flux.
It definitely is. And that's partly why cases like Egelhoff are so important. They make us rethink our assumptions and really grapple with this complex connection between personal responsibility, mental states, and how the law itself evolves.
It makes me think about how society views alcohol and addiction now versus like in the past. You know, drunkenness used to be seen as like a moral failing, but now we're more likely to think of it as a medical condition.
Right.
How have those changing perceptions impacted how the law treats intoxication as a defense?
That's a great point. That shift in how society views alcohol and addiction has definitely impacted the law. As we learn more about the science of addiction, it's harder to just dismiss being intoxicated as a choice that shouldn't matter when determining guilt.
So are we moving toward a system where addiction is considered a reason for leniency in sentencing?
That's a complicated question. There's no easy answer. Some places have special drug courts that focus on treatment and rehab, not punishment. Others have sentencing guidelines that consider addiction. But there's still a lot of debate about how to balance compassion with holding people accountable.
It's a tough balance for sure.
Mm-hmm.
We want people to be responsible for their actions, but we also have to recognize that addiction can really mess with judgment and decision making.
Exactly. And that's why cases like Egelhoff are still relevant today. They highlight the need for a thoughtful and adaptable approach to intoxication and intent, one that considers the latest scientific understanding of addiction, how complex human behavior can be, and those fundamental principles of justice.
So even though Egelhoff is a case from the past, the questions it raises about intoxication, intent, and how the law changes are still very much alive today.
Definitely. And they'll likely be central to legal and societal debates for a long time.
Okay, so we've talked about the specifics of the case, the different legal arguments, and the broader context of intoxication and intent. But what about what happened after the Supreme Court's decision? What kind of impact did Egelhoff have on the legal landscape, and how did it shape the conversation about intoxication defenses?
Well, Egelhoff kind of became a landmark case. Even though it was just a plurality decision, it basically told states they could put limits on or even get rid of intoxication defenses, as long as they had some history in their laws to back it up. This really empowered the dry jurisdictions. You know, those states with really strict rules about alcohol, they really started cracking down on using intoxication as an excuse.
So did this lead to a bunch of states changing their laws to make it tougher to use being drunk as a defense?
You could say that. Egelhoff gave them a roadmap, like how to restrict these defenses without going against the Constitution. It definitely changed things. More states started looking to limit using intoxication as evidence, especially in serious crimes like murder.
But it wasn't a complete win for the states, was it? The dissenting opinions in Egelhoff brought up some serious concerns about due process and the right to present a full defense. Did those just disappear, or did they actually have an impact?
Oh, those concerns definitely didn't go away. In fact, Egelhoff really got a debate going that's still happening today. The model penal code, which a lot of states base their criminal laws on, still says you can consider intoxication when it comes to intent. And even federal courts are split on this. Some follow a stricter approach, like Egelhoff, while others are more open to letting intoxication be used as a defense.
So this case didn't really solve anything, did it? It's more like it created a whole new battleground in the legal world.
Yeah, you can put it that way. Egelhoff became this like key case that everyone refers to in these arguments about intoxication defenses. And it pushed the conversation outside of just legal circles. Lawmakers, academics, even the public had to start wrestling with these tough questions about how we define intent, how we balance individual rights with keeping everyone safe, and what role addiction should have in our justice system.
It sounds like even though the case is over, the conversation it started is still very much alive.
Absolutely. And that's why it's so important to study, even now. It's not just about one guy and one crime. It's about this fundamental tension between personal responsibility and how complicated people are, especially when you throw alcohol into the mix.
All right, so we've covered a lot. The specifics of Egelhoff, the Supreme Court's different opinions, and the bigger implications for intoxication defenses and criminal law in general. But before we wrap up, I want to go back to something we talked about earlier, how legal concepts are always evolving.
That's a key point. Egelhoff perfectly shows how the law isn't static. It's always adapting to new scientific discoveries, changing values in society, and how our understanding of human behavior is evolving.
And in this case, we see how those changes can lead to real clashes between how people interpret legal principles, like due process, and the right to present your defense.
Exactly. And it highlights how those clashes often don't have simple answers. There are good arguments on both sides. And the courts are always trying to find that balance between competing interests.
So what does this all mean for us, the regular folks out there, trying to understand this complicated world of law? What are some key takeaways from Egelhoff that we can use in our own lives and in understanding the legal system?
I think one of the biggest takeaways is that we should try to be more aware of how complex human behavior can be. It's easy to judge what people do, especially when their actions cause harm. But Egelhoff reminds us there are often things going on underneath the surface, things like intoxication, mental health issues, or past trauma. These can have a big impact on someone's choices and how they act.
So instead of judging right away, we should try to be more understanding and compassionate.
I think that's a good lesson to take away. We should also remember that the law is constantly changing. Something that might have been okay or fair in the past could be seen very differently today. And that's actually a good thing. It means we're always trying to create a society that's more just and fair for everyone.
That's a hopeful thought. So as we finish our deep dive into Montana v. Egelhoff, what's the one thing you want our listeners to walk away with?
I think the most important thing is to remember that the law is a reflection of us as a society. It comes from our values, our beliefs, and how we see the world. And as we continue to grow and learn, the law has to grow and learn too.
Well said. And on that note, we'll let our listeners keep exploring these questions, which are complicated but so interesting. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Montana v. Egelhoff. Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep working towards a more just world.